I next met with Dr. Heather Wakely, the principal investigator of the major Kern Intergroup Non-Small Cell Adjuvant Trial, ECOG 1505, evaluating the addition of 1 year of treatment with bevacizumab in patients receiving cisplatin-based chemo. I asked Dr. Wakely to pick a couple of patients from her practice to discuss, but to begin, I followed a line of questioning that began recently in interviews with researchers in breast cancer, myeloma, lymphoma, and others about the kinds of cases they evaluate as second opinions in their practices.
They're normally patients who are like the other patients in my practice. They're mostly going to have advanced stage lung cancer. There'll be a few who are coming after surgery with adjuvant questions. And most of the time, if it's coming from the patient, it's the patient with a new diagnosis who is anxious and just wants reassurance that they're on the right treatment course.
Can you reflect back on the many patients you've seen in this kind of situation and pick out two or three clinical situations or issues where your recommendation is significantly different than kind of what they've heard before? So you see it kind of differently. Any kind of situations where that tends to happen?
Yeah, that's actually come up a lot recently with adjuvant chemotherapy. So when patients come to see me asking about adjuvant chemotherapy, obviously I'll talk with them about the 1505 clinical trial. But even when they're not eligible for the trial, I'll talk about chemotherapy. And I use a lot of a cisplatin and pemetrexed combination or cisplatin and gemcitabine if the patient has squamous histology. And I find that in our community, there's still a real push for the cisplatin vinorelbine. And when I come back with recommendations to use pemetrexed or gemcitabine instead of vinorelbine, I get a lot of pushback from the community doctors feeling that there isn't enough data. And yet, as you know, when I've spoken with other folks who just live in the lung cancer world, there's been a huge swing towards that combination and adjuvant treatment. And so that's been the one that's really struck me the most recently, that adjuvant question. It's come up a few times where the referring physician really doesn't pick up that recommendation to switch to a different chemotherapy.
You know, it's interesting you should say that because I had a phone call this morning with a physician in practice. And we were going through some cases for our CME thing, and we were talking about a case, adjuvant situation, where this physician was going to use cisvinorelbine. And I said, well, you know, it's interesting because, you know, we've been polling investigators. We're seeing a lot of cis-hem.
When I think about the toxicity differences, to me, it just doesn't make sense. Patients have a much easier time getting through a cisplatin pemetrexed regimen than the vinorelbine regimens for the most part.
Now, this oncologist, sort of along the lines of what you were saying, comment on the, quote, lack of data with adjuvant PEM. Yet there was a trial presented last year at ASCO, and in fact, you were the discussant, the so-called TREAT study that looked at this.
Right. So the TREAT trial is the only randomized study looking at cisplatin pemetrexed in an adjuvant setting. It was a small trial. It was a phase two, randomized phase two, done by some of the German groups. And they looked at cispem versus cisvinorelbine. Their primary endpoint was tolerability. And they showed that the cispem was significantly better tolerated. They were able to get not just higher dose intensity for the PEM, but also for the cisplatin, because patients weren't having to drop off with neutropenia or other complications. They didn't present their efficacy data yet. And when I discussed this at ASCO last year, I pointed out that they had a lot of stage 1B patients. They also had a lot of squamous histology patients. The trial had been initiated before the histology issues with pemetrexed were known. And so I don't know that we're going to get a good efficacy signal from that trial. It hasn't yet been published, and so I think we're all looking to see what additional data comes out. But I don't know that we're going to have a lot of other trials that are specifically designed to look at the chemotherapy questions.
The striking thing about TREAT was that about 5% of patients who got cis-PEM had treatment stopped due to toxicity versus 25% on cisvinorelbine. And it was interesting when I asked this oncologist how the patient was doing on cisvinorelbine. The answer was there were a lot of quality of life issues and dose delays because of counts. Your adjuvant ECOG trial is looking at Bev, but you had a poster at ASCO last year beginning to look at the issue of within the trial how people did on the different chemo regimens.
obviously one of the things we're excited about from ECOG 1505, that the primary endpoint, of course, is whether or not bevacizumab adds to adjuvant chemotherapy. But in the trial design, we allow for four different chemotherapy backbones. So we have the cisplatin vinorelbine, of course, but we also have the cisplatin docetaxel, cisplatin gemcitabine, and for patients with non-squamous histology, cisplatin pemetrexed. And we know from data we looked at and presented last year that physicians around the country are enrolling patients and putting them on all of those different arms almost equally. And so we are going to have some comparative data. The study's not designed to look at that per se, but we'll, of course, be able to do some secondary analyses to make sure that we really are on the right track when we're thinking about other chemotherapy regimens in that setting. And of course, you know, the NCCN guidelines allow for any cisplatin backbone-based doublet as an adjuvant treatment. I mean, their panel of experts felt that that was reasonable.
And actually, you have a patient we're going to talk about who went on that trial. But before we kind of get off the second opinion thing, any other situations where you find yourself seeing things differently than maybe the first oncologist?
I think the other setting where that comes up a lot is with stage three patients. And that gets to the fact that we don't have standard treatment guidelines for stage three. There are so many variables that come into play and such a dearth of data that we're really left having to come up with a very individual plan for each patient. And so in that setting, and again, that's normally going to be discussed in our tumor board where it's not just me, but it's our radiation oncologists and surgeons weighing in too, we will sometimes come up with a more aggressive approach or different chemotherapy recommendations. And so that's where there can be differences, but it's harder to argue because no one's really operating from level one evidence. We're all coming at it from what evidence is out there and our own personal biases that have come from practice over years.
We're going to talk about one of your stage three cases also, but just kind of as a prelude, what is it that you're typically doing in this situation that oncologists in practice are not? Is it pre-op therapy? Is it, you know, what I see a lot of controversy, post-chemo radiation treatment, even choice of what to give during radiation?
I think that's where a lot of it comes in. I'm just thinking of a case I had yesterday where a patient had stage 3B disease, had completed concurrent cisplatin etoposide with radiation, and she had come to see me when she had started treatment, and I felt that that was a very appropriate regimen to give. She finished her radiation and then got an additional two cycles, so she had a total of four cycles of that combination, and that tends to be my practice pattern as well. So there were no controversies there, but where controversy came up was her treating physician was recommending additional chemotherapy beyond that, and I felt that there really wasn't data to support that approach. And so that was one recent one where there's been a difference of opinion.
We actually today are sending out an email about management of stage three non-small cell, and we surveyed 10 investigators about this. I don't think you were in that one, but we certainly saw cis etoposide. We saw carbopaclitaxel. What about, again, getting back to PEM, and it's being looked at in a trial, but what about cis-PEM with concurrent chemo radiation?
I will sometimes go with that regimen. We don't have extensive data yet. We've seen some that has come out of a CLGB, which looked encouraging, and it certainly is a reasonably well-tolerated regimen. So I have, in certain circumstances, gone with that approach. But if someone asks me, how do you treat stage three, I don't have a clear answer. It really becomes an individual patient decision each time.
You mentioned about adjuvant tolerance of treatment in the chemo radiation setting, whether PEM is better tolerated as a partner than the other agents?
With the chemo radiation, the radiation part of it, with the esophagitis in particular, really trumps most of the other toxicities. And I have not, in my own experience, seen a clear difference across those three different commonly used regimens. There's a lot of variability by patient as to who has bad esophagitis and who doesn't. And I can't say that I can pin it to the regimen exactly, but really more to patient factors we haven't been able to sort out very well.
So let's talk a little bit about your cases, beginning with your 52-year-old man who actually ended up in your study, the ECOG 1505 trial.
So this patient is a 52-year-old Asian man. And in 2010, he was diagnosed with non-small cell lung cancer. He was being seen for a chronic cough, and his physician ordered a chest X-ray, which showed an area of concern. This was then followed by a CT scan showing a 1.7-centimeter nodule in his right upper lobe. He underwent then a fine needle aspiration, and I think there was a little bit more tissue than that, but ended up showing adenocarcinoma consistent with a lung origin. He then had a PET scan, which confirmed this right upper lobe mass, but also showed some uptake in hilar and a paratracheal lymph node.
And what was his smoking history?
He did not have a significant smoking history. I think he'd smoked a little bit in college, but nothing substantial.
So what happened?
So he continued his workup. He had a negative brain MRI, and then the surgical approach was planning to do a mediastinoscopy, and if that was clear, going on to resection. And again, you know, there was some uptake on the paratracheal nodes, but no enlargement on the CT scan. So the mediastinoscopy on frozen, the lymph nodes were all negative. So he was taken then for the bilobectomy, so the right upper lobe, and then the right middle lobe was also taken. The final pathology from that confirmed this 1.8-centimeter primary adenocarcinoma in the right upper lobe, but he also had 8 involved lymph nodes, and should point out that there were 26 nodes taken, and that's what we like to see in a path report, is a lot of hilar and mediastinal nodes coming out so we can really verify stage. Unfortunately, those lymph nodes were involved, and they included some of the N2 nodes at level 7 and 2, even though the frozen had been negative on the mediastinoscopy. So his final stage was a T1, N2, M0, stage 3A, but most of the lymph node involvement was fairly small.
So things are moving pretty quickly in lung cancer, and when you present this man being diagnosed, I guess about 2 years ago now, mm-hmm. You know, it's interesting historically how things are moving, but did he have mutation testing?
No, we did not do that at that time.
And if he were to present today, would he?
I don't think so. The mutation analysis, as of yet, does not help us with these early stage patients. We don't know how to incorporate the targeted agents into a curative regimen at this time. We are all awaiting the results from the RADIANT trial, which looked at adjuvant erlotinib, and they are doing mutation analyses. So we will know for the subset of patients who went on that trial who had EGFR mutations how they fared with adjuvant erlotinib or not. We obviously are way too early in the ALK story to know what to do with crizotinib in a potentially curative patient. So we're still left with the standard modalities of primarily surgery, radiation where appropriate, adjuvant chemotherapy where appropriate to try to cure these patients. So one could look from a curiosity perspective and knowing what to do next if they recur, but I don't know that it's going to change what we're doing for these patients yet. They're, again, ongoing trials.
I wouldn't argue with the issue about whether it's going to change what you're going to do, but let me just be a little bit of a devil's advocate and ask you, what do you think the chances this man does have a tumor mutation?
He is an Asian man. He has a light smoking history, so it's going to be in the 40% range or so.
40%. And suppose I said, well, you know, in breast cancer, every time we get tissue, we do ER and HER2. Granted, what you're saying about we don't really know what it means in adjuvant therapy and non-small cell, but how about if I say, well, you know, he has a very high likelihood of recurrence. Wouldn't it be nice when he walks in, unfortunately, maybe has bone pain or whatever, you already know his mutation status?
Our testing only takes about a week, so I think it's a reasonable argument. It's also one where if we're talking about healthcare costs, that needs to come into that discussion because that would be getting a test, which can be relatively expensive without it necessarily impacting patient care at that time. And certainly with a stage 3A, his likelihood of recurrence is fairly high. I hear your point, and I've certainly heard it argued before, and I probably used it in some cases. However, I don't know that we should be arguing to test all of these patients at this time. Occasionally when I'm discussing with a patient about whether or not to do that testing, because they do ask, I'll sometimes recommend that we wait while we have tissue. The tests are evolving so quickly that the things I'm going to be looking for in 2 years are probably going to be different than what I'm looking for now, EGFR mutation might be the same, but as you know, the ROS story came out this year, the ROS1, the RET story's evolving. I mean, there are many, many things that we are learning all the time. So I'd rather not use up the tissue if it's a small specimen doing tests for today when there are going to be new tests for tomorrow or whenever he does end up having a relapse.
Okay, well, that's a very persuasive argument. Maybe later on we'll talk a little bit about ROS. But one more question, just because it is interesting. Incidentally, do you give more weight to him being Asian in terms of possibility, or is it really just about smoking?
The smoking's most important, but at least with the EGFR story, Asian ethnicity does seem to play some role.
So just throwing it out there, let's just say somehow this patient got mutation testing. Maybe he's coming to you for a second opinion. He's known, let's just say, to have an EGFR mutation. He reads up on it and he says, well, you know, sure, I'll take the chemo and all, but how about giving me some erlotinib after it's all done? Would you say absolutely not, or maybe, or yes?
So we have a trial at our institution. One of my colleagues, Joel Neal, had come from MGH where they are doing an adjuvant erlotinib trial. So we do have that trial open, and I would discuss it in the context of that trial. However, I have not been advocating for that off of trial, and I actually think that outside of the context of a clinical trial, there's potential that we're harming patients by giving adjuvant erlotinib. There's a potential we're harming them by giving adjuvant anything until we've done the trial and proven that it's helpful. I certainly have some concerns based on the BR19, the adjuvant gefitinib trial. It was stopped early with the negative gefitinib data that had come out in metastatic setting, or wasn't negative but non-positive, I should say. In that trial, they randomized patients to either get gefitinib or placebo after complete resection and allowed for chemo for some of the patients. Overall, the study did not show a benefit to the gefitinib. What I'm concerned about is that they did do a subset analysis on patients with EGFR mutations, and they also did not show any benefit from the adjuvant gefitinib. If anything, they looked like they did worse with it. Again, it was stopped early. They didn't get much treatment. It was small numbers. There are a lot of caveats there. So I don't think we should come away from that thinking that adjuvant gefitinib is necessarily harmful. But we also can't say that there's a clear hint it's helpful either. And so I think that the RADIANT trial, the trials like the one we're doing focused only in the EGFR mutant tumors, need to be done. But until they're done and we have a clear signal, I'm not recommending it off study.
So maybe you can reflect a little bit on the conversation that went on between you and this patient in terms of what the option would be in terms of outside a trial and then on a trial, specifically the ECOG study.
So this was a patient with, again, stage 3A. And one of the things that you need to talk about there, of course, is adjuvant radiation. He had microscopic disease, and so we did discuss him at our tumor board, but felt that given the limited amount of involvement, the fact that he had a very good mediastinal lymph node dissection, we did not think that adjuvant radiation should be recommended, but we did talk with him about that.
And just to be clear, if you wanted to give radiation, could that be done as part of the ECOG trial?
No, it couldn't have been.
Okay.
But that needed to be the question first before we discussed the study for him.
Right.
So we made the decision that we would not be recommending adjuvant radiation. And then we moved to the discussion of chemotherapy, and that was one I had with him. And I explained that with the data we have so far, the addition of chemotherapy improves his chance of being cured by somewhere between 5 to 10%. And I wish that it was more than that, but that's what we know we can offer with chemotherapy. And given that he is young and otherwise healthy, I really didn't think that there was any reason not to pursue chemotherapy. Because he had the mixed adeno and squamous, we went back and forth about the chemotherapy, and I ended up recommending docetaxel. As we talked earlier, I'll often give pemetrexed even when it's mixed, if it's majority non-squam, but we had decided for him for the docetaxel regimen. So we talked about that, and then after we discussed chemo, I talked about the study. And when I mentioned the trial to patients, I discussed the fact that it's randomized, and so if they decide to do the study, there's a 50% chance they're going to get the same chemo we were recommending anyway, but there's a 50% chance that they will also get the bevacizumab. And we talk about the rationale about why the study was designed, as well as the potential toxicities with the hypertension, bleeding risks, but go through that we only have a 5 to 10% benefit from the chemo. We're really hoping to find something that's going to do more. That's why we're optimistic about the trial, but we just don't know whether there's benefit or not. So after that discussion, he decided he did want to do the study, even though he knew it would require, if he was randomized to bevacizumab, an additional 9 months where he would be having to come every 3 weeks for treatment.
So what happened with him in terms of the randomization?
So he was randomized to the bevacizumab arm, and he actually tolerated the whole year of treatment quite well. He had some hypertension, but we were able to control that pretty easily. So he completed all of his therapy last July, and he's doing great. I just saw him 2 weeks ago. No evidence of disease on his scans. Back at work.
Just out of curiosity, any nosebleeds?
He didn't have any epistaxis, no. Some patients do, but he did not.
At this point, do we have any data from this trial in terms of tolerability of bevacizumab in this setting in these patients?
So the data that I presented at ASCO and at the ISLC World Lung Conference last summer, we discussed that we had not seen any unexpected toxicities. We really did not assess how many patients were able to complete the full year of treatment. We haven't gone back and analyzed that in detail.
When are you hoping slash expecting to maybe have some efficacy data from the trial?
So we're expecting to finish accrual sometime about a year from now, actually. So we're closing in. It's an overall survival primary endpoint. We have been enrolling for 5 years now. And so obviously we have had some outcomes. As far as predicting when we're going to hit our survival endpoint, it's going to be several years still.
Of course, you know, lung cancer is lung cancer, and colon and breast and all the other tumors where bevacizumab is being looked at as other cancers. But I'm curious about your perspective on what's been seen in other tumors, particularly the colorectal data that the NSABP presented in the past. And then more recently, kind of tying into the issue of, in my mind, duration, I guess it's just a press release. We'll see the data at ASCO from an advanced disease colorectal study where bevacizumab continuation on progression seemed to result in a survival benefit. You know, sort of both of those things kind of tying into duration. You mentioned 1 year in your study. What are your thoughts about all that?
Grapple with those questions all the time. When we were initially designing the study, we had talked about a longer continuation of bevacizumab, perhaps as long as 2 years, given that that's the highest likelihood of any recurrences in lung cancer, but just felt the patients weren't going to be willing to go on a 2-year treatment and had concerns about the toxicity with that long of a duration. So that's how we settled on the 1 year. After the colon data came out showing that patients did well while they were on bevacizumab, but after the bevacizumab was stopped, there seemed to be an increase in the recurrences such that in the end, the bevacizumab arm was no different than the non-bevacizumab arm. We certainly grappled with that question again, but did not feel that it warranted changing the trial design. Colon and lung are obviously very different. The recurrence patterns are different. But it is a question, and I think that with these agents that are suppressing as opposed to necessarily killing, when we release that suppression, there's always the risk that we're going to get back to where we had been before that happened. And the colon data in metastatic settings showing the patients who continued bevacizumab indefinitely seemed to have better outcomes than those who stopped it after a set period of time is certainly intriguing to support that hypothesis. Again, we don't know that that's the same in lung. And so I haven't come up with any good answers to that question still. I think you asked me that 4 or 5 years ago when we did one of these. And I think we still have a lot of questions there.
So just for practical purposes, maybe this kind of ties into your next case, but are there any situations if you're using, you know, some kind of chemo with bevacizumab and metastatic disease, patient has a long response, doing well, then has slow progression, where you would continue the bevacizumab and switch the chemo?
I haven't done that in practice. There is a trial that is being run through the PRECOG mechanism, so a branch of ECOG, where patients who are on a bevacizumab maintenance are randomized when they progress to either continue on the bevacizumab when a new agent is added or to not do that. And those who are on the continue bevacizumab arm continue it through second and third line even. So that's going to provide some very important information about the utility of continuation of the drug. Until we have that information, I have not continued it at the time of progression.
So just to kind of follow up on that concept, what about the patient with an EGFR mutation, has a great response to erlotinib for a prolonged time, then has slow progression? Any situations where you'll keep the erlotinib going and add something else in?
So in that setting, I do continue with the erlotinib for as long as possible, even when their disease is growing slowly, sort of waiting until they cross a threshold of the size of the disease or there's a change in how it's growing. I have occasionally considered adding bevacizumab to the erlotinib in that situation where they've had a slow progression but otherwise seem to be doing quite well. I have not added chemotherapy to it routinely. I am always very cautious when I stop erlotinib in patients who have known mutations. Most of them do fine when you stop it and are able to then go on to chemotherapy and respond to it. But there are a handful who have a rapid progression when you release the EGFR inhibition. And for those folks, they usually can tell within a couple days, and they're ones I will then put them right back on and then would consider adding chemotherapy to it. But I really haven't done that as routine practice. There's certainly controversy on that. If you, and I know you do, talk to opinion leaders around the country, there are some people who feel very strongly that we should never release the EGFR inhibition once it's initiated. I'm not one of those folks, so I just haven't been convinced, and I certainly in my own practice have a number of patients with known mutations who are able to get off erlotinib, able to have a nice response to chemotherapy, and then we're looking for other approaches to EGFR inhibition on clinical trials.
So let's talk about another patient. How about your 57-year-old lady?
Sure. So this is a patient who is also Asian. This is my practice in Northern California. Delightful woman, and she presented with sudden left eye vision loss. She was admitted to the hospital. Brain MRI showed questionable leptomeningeal enhancement, and they continued looking and found that she had a right lung mass and a lot of smaller pulmonary nodules. Did a biopsy. It was consistent with adenocarcinoma, and then I was called into the case and met her. She had a core biopsy done, so we were able to do extensive mutation testing, and she was found to be wild type for EGFR, KRAS, and BRAF, and on FISH testing for the ALK translocation. We therefore felt that she needed to be started on chemotherapy. And again, there was no clear or definitive CNS involvement. It was just she'd lost a vision. It seemed very suggestive that she had CNS involvement, but there was no target for the radiation oncologist to go after.
What was her smoking history?
Absolutely none.
Non-smoker with no mutations. And as you were beginning treatment or making a decision, how were you conceptualizing what was going on in terms of her vision? Was it cranial nerve or optical nerve or what?
I was worried about optical nerve involvement, but again, we couldn't prove it, so nobody wanted to radiate it.
So what did you decide to do with her?
I decided to put her on carboplatin. We talked about carbo versus cis, but she didn't want to be most aggressive possible. She wanted to treat this, but was wary of the cisplatin toxicity. So we went with carboplatin. I picked pemetrexed because this was an adenocarcinoma. And then I decided to give her bevacizumab. I did that because she had this potential CNS involvement, because she was young, and I felt that she really needed to have not just stability, but if we could try to shrink it, that would probably be better for her. And bevacizumab across the board in all the trials absolutely increases response rate. So when I need a response, I'm much more inclined towards it.
So, you know, just really just rolling around in my head the fact that this woman was a non-smoker. And of course, this was, I guess, more than a year ago. But what about the ROS1 mutation or mutation testing in somebody like this?
We're trying to get it done.
Yeah, I would think so. Can you explain kind of a little bit about what that is and why you'd be thinking about it in her?
Sure. So there was a JCO publication that had come out in the last couple of months looking at this new translocation that's been identified. It's another driver mutation in lung cancer. It's probably only about 2% of all lung cancers. And patients who have it tend to be patients who fit the same profile for the ALK or EGFR, I guess more towards the ALK. I haven't seen that there's a sex predominance favoring women the way there was for EGFR. But the patients do tend to be never smokers. And so when we're trying to figure out the driver mutation for someone like this who you think should have a known driver mutation, that's one of the things that's now routinely being added to the panels. I don't think I can say that it is routinely checked yet at most places, but it is being added to the panels being done at the academic center. So our pathologists have their Ross fish assay ready to start up, I think, in another week or so, but we aren't doing it yet. But she is certainly someone, and as I've known her, really been trying to figure out what driving mutation there must be, but we haven't identified one yet.
What an amazing article that was. And then there was an editorial by Dr. Yane, but I guess the thing that really catches your attention, at least caught my attention, is they had one case in there and they showed the scans of a patient who had a really dramatic response to crizotinib.
Right.
I don't know how many other cases or people have been treated at this point, but just seeing that one's enough to get you kind of motivated.
They have a handful. I know that they're collecting cases around the country and trying to get a series so that we can have a better sense of what is the response rate. But hopefully the crizotinib will pan out to be as useful in ROS as it is in ALK.
So this lady was the pre-ROS 1 days, which is only, as you say, a couple months ago.
Right.
What actually happened once you treated her?
She had a dramatic improvement. I was not expecting to see this, but she regained her vision completely. This shocked the ophthalmologist as well. And she did wonderfully for 9 months before starting to have some progression.
So just to clarify, she had no vision essentially, and then it came back?
Yeah, it was amazing.
Wow. And how exactly was she treated in terms of, you said it was for 9 months. What did she get exactly during those 9 months?
So the first four cycles, carboplatin, pemetrexed, and bevacizumab. And then after we had gone through the four cycles, I dropped the carboplatin, but continued on both pemetrexed and bevacizumab.
Sounds a little bit like the so-called Patel regimen. Can you explain what that is and the so-called point break study that's going to look at that? And hopefully we're going to see some information on that soon.
Sure. So Jyothi Patel at Northwestern piloted a phase two trial where patients received that exact regimen I just described, where they get four cycles of the triplet and then the carboplatin's dropped and their maintenance is with both pemetrexed and bevacizumab. And they had very encouraging response, progression-free, and overall survival. So this got people's attention and launched a phase three trial comparing that regimen to the standard ECOG 4599 regimen that Alan Sandler had brought forward with the carboplatin at area under the curve of 6, paclitaxel at 200 milligrams per meter squared, and bevacizumab at 15 milligrams per kilogram. And in that setting, the chemotherapy and bevacizumab is given for 4 to 6 cycles, and then bevacizumab alone is continued. So different chemo, but also different maintenance plan. And so those two regimens have been compared head-to-head in the trial you mentioned and finished accrual, and we're hoping that we're going to hear the results sometime this spring or summer.
Any sort of guesses what might be seen there, both in terms of efficacy and toxicity? How did this lady tolerate the treatment?
So I think for efficacy, we can pretty safely say that pemetrexed is better tolerated than paclitaxel, at least for the alopecia, the neuropathy, the infusion reactions are all much better. And the bone marrow suppression, obviously, with both of them is fairly low. So in my practice, the drug's much better tolerated, and she tolerated it quite well. There's obviously fatigue with chemotherapy. Neither of those regimens has much nausea. So again, both reasonably tolerated, but pemetrexed seems to be a bit of an edge there. As far as efficacy, I tend to give the pemetrexed regimen over the paclitaxel regimen, but that is mostly a tolerability issue. I can't say that I'm going to put my neck out too far about which one's going to be more efficacious.
Let's talk about one more case. How about your 55-year-old woman?
Sure. So this was a 55-year-old Caucasian woman who in the summer of 2007, so that tells you something about the case, developed a cough and was found to have a right upper lobe mass on a chest x-ray. On CT scan, this was confirmed. Biopsy consistent with a non-mucinous, what we were calling at the time, bronchoalveolar carcinoma, now the adenocarcinoma in situ. And the markers were consistent, TTF1 positive, CK7 positive. She had a right upper lobectomy, then had adjuvant chemotherapy, but recurred about a year later with multifocal lung disease. She had EGFR mutation testing done, but none of the known driver mutations were identified.
She was a non-smoker?
Light smoker. I think she had about a 15-pack year smoking history. This early part of the care was before I got to know her. So her treating physician put her on erlotinib, and she actually did well for about a year and a half on it. So even though we didn't have a known mutation, clearly was responding quite well, as if she did. She probably does, but we're just not one of the known ones. She had progression of disease eventually on the erlotinib and then was put on pemetrexed without any response. She then was put on gemcitabine, didn't tolerate it, and then she came to see me because we were running a trial with cabozantinib, the XL184. The trial that she enrolled on was designed for patients who had previously responded to erlotinib, focusing on the hope that it would work for patients who had a secondary resistance. She went on the cabozantinib alone arm. It was a randomized study of erlotinib plus cabozantinib or just the cabozantinib. And she actually had a response, shrinkage of her pulmonary nodules, feeling pretty well. She was certainly having toxicity issues, as almost all of our chemotherapy drugs. So that particular agent has a VEGF inhibition as well as MET inhibition. So she developed some hypertension, hand and foot syndrome, diarrhea, but all of these we've been able to manage with other medications. And she's been able to continue working full time. She's an active mom as well, and she is still on trial.
Of course, we've been hearing some really interesting things about cabozantinib and prostate cancer. Can you talk a little bit more about specifically what cabozantinib does, what we know about it in lung cancer, what you think about it in general, particularly in terms of what we've seen in prostate cancer?
So it's a VEGFR RET, R-E-T, RET, and MET inhibitor, pretty potent against all of them. It's an oral agent. Reasonably tolerated, though you can run into the issues with hypertension, rashes like the hand and foot syndrome. In lung, as a single agent, response rates are in the 10% range. The biggest trial with it was a randomized discontinuation trial that involved multiple different disease types. And in that trial, all patients received drug for approximately 3 months. And then they were randomized if they had stable disease to either get the drug or placebo. So a lot of information from that run-in period where everyone was getting drug, and impressive responses seen in bone disease, especially in prostate. Lung cancer, of course, has some bone disease. I haven't seen too many analyses looking just at that part of it, but the prostate data is very striking, presented at ASCO, and they're pursuing it in that setting. Also in thyroid cancer.
I guess one of the things about the prostate was like the normalization of bone scans, which people are scratching their heads about.
Right. Yeah. No, I mean, and pain improvement, more importantly than anything, significant pain improvement.
Now, this strategy of people who've had EGFR TKI like erlotinib and then doing a trial of combining something with it, we saw that with the so-called MetMab. We saw that with ARC-197. Can you explain what those two agents are and sort of what the thinking is about these kinds of trials?
Both of those agents, the ARQ-197 or tivantinib and the MetMab or onartuzumab, they are both drugs that inhibit MET, M-E-T. Different mechanisms of how they do that, but really focusing on the MET itself. Those trials that you mentioned were both randomized phase 2 trials, and they were both in patients who actually were erlotinib naive, so different than this work with cabozantinib. The cabozantinib was in patients who were refractory or had developed a secondary resistance. The ARQ-197 and the MetMab were both for patients who were erlotinib naive. And so in those two trials, patients were randomized to get erlotinib or erlotinib plus the MET drug. Well, in the ARQ-197, there was a PFS benefit and a OS trend for patients who got the MET inhibitor. And so that's gone on to a big phase 3. The MetMab story was a little bit more complicated because in the intent to treat, there was no difference in PFS or OS. But when they looked at MET expression and they just looked at MET immunohistochemistry expression, patients who had high MET expression actually had a substantial benefit with the MetMab. And those who did not have high expression did not have the benefit. If anything, there was potential harm. And so that has led to a focused phase 3 trial only in patients who have that MET expression. And that trial is looking at erlotinib plus or minus the MetMab. There are also trials in development looking at the MetMab, onartuzumab, for patients in combination with chemotherapy. So those trials are getting launched now.
And what's the thinking in terms of, is there some connection between the MET pathway and the EGFR pathway?
They certainly are interconnected. There's been some work showing that in some of the patients who develop resistance to an EGFR TKI, MET overexpression has been discovered, and a lot of the downstream effects of MET and EGFR are similar. So if EGFR is knocked out, MET overexpression can compensate. There's a bit of a dispute in the literature about how big of a role that plays. Some of the early reports said that was 20% of acquired resistance. More recent reports have said it's a smaller percentage. And so while they definitely have interplay, how much, I think we're still learning.
Now, what about these two agents? I guess MetMab is a monoclonal antibody, but there is potential, or seems like there's some toxicity. What do you see with that? And what about tivantinib?
So with anything targeting MET, we are seeing some edema. That's one of the toxicities that's been seen as a class effect. Otherwise, the drugs have been reasonably well tolerated. I mean, you're going to see some LFT abnormalities with any agents, a little bit of rash, but it's mostly this edema has been really the class effect toxicity that we've had to figure out how to deal with.
Any comments about the irreversible EGFR TKI afatinib, particularly combined with cetuximab in patients progressing on a reversible TKI like erlotinib?
So erlotinib and cetuximab was highly toxic, horrible rashes, no efficacy. The afatinib plus cetuximab combination was piloted by William Pao based on some laboratory work that he had done. And it was presented at ASCO, and then an update was given at the IASLC, International Association for the Study of Lung Cancer World Lung Conference, which was held this summer, and Leora Horn gave that presentation and showed a waterfall plot, which was striking. So they had patients who had all had acquired resistance to EGFR. Most of them had EGFR mutations, had done very, very well with erlotinib for a while, and then became resistant. I mean, this waterfall plot only had very few patients who weren't responding. Everybody else was having a minor or complete or partial response. I think the response rate was over 50%. It was really striking. And that was regardless of whether or not they had the T790M mutation. And again, that's the most common resistance mechanism is this T790M mutation, which changes the binding pocket. And patients who have that, erlotinib no longer works. So lots of excitement about that, and that's being followed up.
You mentioned the dermatologic toxicity with erlotinib cetuximab in terms of qualitatively how much of a problem it was with afatinib cetuximab.
It was strikingly low on the afatinib cetuximab, and there were certainly some grade 2-3 rashes, but the percentage was low.